We start this morning with my guest, Ryan Schultz. He holds 4 degrees from Oregon State University and is the state veterinarian for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. He assumed this role in 2020, bringing with him extensive experience in emergency management and animal disease control. Dr. Schultz is responsible for overseeing the health of a wide range of animals, from livestock to household pets. As the state veterinarian, Dr. Schultz's primary responsibilities include preventing and tracking livestock diseases, supporting practicing veterinarians across the state, and implementing regulations related to animal health, such as certificates of veterinary inspection, livestock identification and tracking, and quarantines for infected animals. His work also involves close coordination with the Oregon Health Authority, particularly on diseases that can be transmitted between animals and humans. Welcome to The Exchange, Dr. Schultz.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you.
Well, let's start with your background, since it's quite extensive. You have 4 degrees and a lot of experience in the field. So tell us about your journey to becoming Oregon's top veterinarian.
Yeah, so I was born and raised here in Oregon. I was grew up on a small farm outside of Newburg. Grew up around livestock, around animals, and kind of always wanted to be a vet. Never really pictured myself in the traditional clinical practice, though. So when I went to OSU for my undergrad, I did it was a double major between animal science and did a second major called bioresource research, which was a kind of a research based. What I thought I wanted to do at that time was really the research aspect of things, and quickly found that, as my dad puts it, I am a goal oriented person, not a detail oriented person, and research probably was not the field for me. And discovered public health and really fell in love with that, of the ability to have a bigger impact, and you know, every day is a new thing. And so ended up going on to vet school there at OSU, and then after that did a master's of public health in epidemiology in the College of Public Health there.
So what does a state veterinarian do?
Yes. Good question. It varies a lot day by day. My primary role is being the department's, and really the state's, expert on controlling infectious diseases in animals, controlling the diseases we have here that are a high impact, and preventing diseases we don't have here from becoming established. Both for the diseases that have a potential to impact animals, as well as diseases we call zoonotic diseases, that are diseases that can jump from animals to humans or vice versa sometimes as well. There's a number of other things that go along with that in terms of regulating movement of animals into the state, making sure that animals coming here are being checked by a vet before they come, that there's testing in some cases or vaccinations that happen. And then there's a number of other lesser duties. We get involved a lot in disaster response, supporting the counties when it comes to animals. And then we also regulate commercial livestock feeds, and we license animal rescues as well.
What are livestock?
So that's a very good question. In my world, it depends a lot on what law you're talking about. So everything we do is underpinned by a statute or an administrative rule. In terms of disease control, we have a really, really broad definition of livestock, which is somewhat unique to Oregon, which allows us to work with a lot of species when we're talking about controlling diseases. So in Oregon, in terms of disease control, livestock are essentially, you know, the traditional species of livestock, but then it's essentially any vertebrate that is held in captivity, and other than fish. Fish are specifically excluded from that. They're the purview of Department of Fish and Wildlife, but pretty much any vertebrate that's held in captivity. So your traditional wildlife species, but that also includes dogs and cats, and it includes captive wildlife species or exotic type animals, and a lot of those other species that are capable of harboring or becoming infected with these same diseases. And so it provides us a kind of a unique scope in that we can really make an impact on some of these diseases.
So a bunny rabbit is livestock?
They are considered livestock, yes.
Last year, you led a webinar titled "A Veterinary Approach to the One Health Approach." What is Oregon's One Health System?
Yeah, so One Health is kind of a concept that meshes together multiple different systems. So it's a recognition that the environment and animals and humans, the health of all three of those, are really inextricably linked, right? When our environment is suffering, it impacts animals, it impacts humans. When humans have or animals have a disease that can potentially pass to, you know, from domestic animals to wild animals. We saw that with rabbit hemorrhagic disease a couple of years ago, where we had domestic rabbits that got sick, and then we had it in some feral domestic rabbits, and then that spilled over into some wild rabbits, and it's still impacting wild rabbits. Similarly, when we have diseases like avian influenza, where we have them in animals, it's spilling over from wildlife, from the environment, into those domestic animals, but then it also spills from those domestic animals into humans. And so the One Health is kind of that combined approach that none of us can do this on our own. We work really closely from the Department of Agriculture with our colleagues in Department of Fish and Wildlife that are dealing with a lot of these diseases in the wildlife species. We also work very closely with our colleagues at Oregon Health Authority in the human aspect of it. And to the extent that when we show up, you know, when someone calls us and says, hey, I think my chickens may have avian influenza, and we send a vet out there to test them, we show up with PPE kits and educational materials for the owners that are provided by Oregon Health Authority. But we recognize that we're going to be there a couple days before public health would be involved, because they're not going to get involved until we know that the chickens are infected. And so we can work together to protect everyone and to stop the disease where it's at. So we work very closely in that One Health model with those partner agencies and a lot of other ones. At the federal level, we work with USDA's Wildlife Services. We work with USDA's Veterinary Services. We work, Oregon Health Authority works with CDC. We work with the county health departments. We work with county animal control agencies. It's kind of a top, an all hands on deck approach when we look at some of these disease responses.
My guest is Dr. Ryan Schultz. He serves as the state veterinarian for the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and you can join us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So, Doc, what does it mean to say that animals are sentinels?
Yeah, so animals oftentimes are highly susceptible to diseases, to toxins. I think a great example is the historical example of the canaries in the coal mine, right? Canaries have very sensitive, birds in general have very sensitive respiratory systems. And so the coal miners would take the canaries down into the coal mine with them, and they would, it's kind of a barbaric system, but those canaries were susceptible to a much lower level of toxins in the air than the miners were. And so they'd use that as a sentinel, that if something happened to that canary, they needed to get out of there. Same kind of concept applies. When we see one part of that One Health system being impacted, we really need to be taking note. When we see diseases in animals that we aren't used to seeing, or when we see, a disease like avian influenza that's really spreading widely, and that is, impacting new species that weren't previously seeing it in, they are a sentinel. That is a disease that can spill over into humans, and we need to change the methods and how we're doing things and really respond to what we're seeing in those sentinel species, so that hopefully we can control it there before it gets into people and before it becomes a new pandemic in people.
So speaking of bird flu, avian influenza, mm-hmm. What's the impact of changes in migration of migratory birds, and how does bird flu factor into the equation?
By changes in migratory behavior, are you referring to due to changes in climate?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's hard to say. I think that ultimately, anytime that the waterfowl are migrating to a different area, it creates new exposures. The avian influenza as a disease is kind of held as a reservoir in wild waterfowl, particularly dabbling ducks, things like mallards, teals, those type of species. They can carry the virus for months without showing any symptoms. And so they are often carrying that disease with them when they're migrating. And so when you have changes in migratory patterns, it is going to impact exposures to new wild species. It's going to impact, you know, new spillovers potentially when you have birds that are stopping over in areas they're not normally used to seeing. The, you know, I think the impact is more conceptual at this point. We, as a country, the U.S. has been dealing with highly pathogenic avian influenza since 2022. We haven't, it feels like forever when we've been dealing with it, and, you know, from my end. But when you look at it in that grand scale of what impact is climate change and some of those things having on it, it's really hard to say, to pinpoint differences between essentially three migratory seasons that we've been through now with that virus, to be able to say, yeah, that right there, and, you know, in that year where it was different, or something to those that effect. I do think, though, as we see both changes in climate and, you know, the normal ranges of animals and animal movements change, as well as when you overlay that with the increased globalization of trade and travel, I think it's bound to continue to see these kind of new and emerging disease events happen.
Well, we move around the state quite often and through states. What does the data tell you about bird flu and the spread of bird flu here in Oregon?
Yeah, so here in Oregon, we've seen a very seasonal trend to cases of bird flu in domestic animals, because that's obviously what I deal with. But it is very heavily connected to the migratory season. And really, we tend to see our cases in domestic poultry happening mainly in the fall, with the fall migration. And I think there's a couple reasons for that, connected with just how that migration happens. And you have new young geese and ducks coming for the first time that get exposed. And there's some different factors there. But we don't tend to see as many in the spring. We tend to see very few cases, other than our first year when this virus was introduced into the flyway in the late spring. And so we had naive birds in the flyway. We really haven't seen that spring and summer cases that we see in some other parts of the country. So really the fall and early winter is when we see the highest risk. Beyond that, though, really we see a potential for cases and a potential for disease anywhere where you have a wild duck or a wild goose that is interacting with domestic poultry. And so that's really been the message we've been trying to get across, is you really can't rely on the time of year. You can't rely on all those things. Really, you have to implement really strong biosecurity with poultry and make sure that you are keeping those domestic birds separate from wild birds, from direct contact and then indirect contact with things like going to the park and walking around the park through a bunch of duck feces and tracking that home into your chicken coop. Or we've seen people who have gone hunting and brought back ducks or geese that they've harvested and, you know, clean those on their back patio, and that water drained through their chicken coop, and that infected their chickens. Things like that, where you get that indirect exposure to those wild waterfowl.
So we've got about a minute before I have to take a break, but what is bird flu, and how do you know that an animal is infected?
Yeah, so bird flu is an influenza A virus, in the same classification as a lot of the influenza A viruses we see in humans, we see in pigs, we see in dogs and cats. It is highly pathogenic, though, or this strain specifically. So what we see typically in poultry especially is those birds end up dying very quickly. We see rapid mortality in birds over just the course of a few days, often without any symptoms.
Wow. How does it spread?
It's predominantly through that direct contact. So, you know, contact of poultry with wild birds. But it can also be, you know, anything that virus can attach to and be carried through. So we've seen it spread in feed, where you have feed that's been contaminated with wild waterfowl. We've seen it spread in water, you know, where ducks that were infected were swimming in a water trough and other animals came and drank out of that. We've seen it spread on boots. We've seen it a lot of different ways where you have infected material that gets brought close to poultry.
Dr. Schultz, what's spillover?
Yeah, so spillover is when we see diseases, it's a term we use for when we see diseases that move from where we normally see the disease into somewhere else. So using the example of avian influenza, we talk about wild waterfowl, wild ducks especially, are the reservoir. That's where this disease exists in nature. So when we see the disease move from them into domestic poultry, that's a spillover into those. When we saw last year this disease somehow make it from wild waterfowl into dairy cattle in the Texas, New Mexico area, that was a spillover. When we see virus move from either dairy cattle or from domestic poultry into the employees that are working on those farms and we see infected people, that's another different spillover event. When we see it, you know, in wild mammals that are scavengers, that would be a spillover event.
So why is there such a concern for dairy cows in particular?
I think mainly because they are getting infected is kind of the short, simple answer of it. The science that goes behind that of how they became infected, why they're getting infected is still formulating a little bit. But what we know is that last year, about March of last year, we learned that some outbreaks that we were seeing in Texas that had been kind of undiagnosed up until that point were diagnosed as being infections with H5N1 avian influenza, the highly pathogenic avian influenza virus we're seeing in poultry. It is a unique strain of that virus that we're seeing in dairy cattle. And then since then, we've seen predominantly that virus move from dairy to dairy. It's really been an infection of cows. It's a mastitis. It's an infection of their udder predominantly. So it affects the lactating cows. But then that means that milk that's coming out of those cows is potentially carrying virus. And so it's really important that we're controlling potential spread from that milk and that we are also pasteurizing that milk because pasteurization inactivates this virus. It was a new spillover event. It was a species that we didn't really know that it was a significant risk. We didn't really have a whole lot of understanding of how it happened originally. We know a lot more now. But it was kind of a watershed event in this virus where we saw it jump into a whole new species that we really were not considering at all at that point. We didn't really have any reason to believe they were susceptible.
About a year ago, you gave a talk that really surprised me. You mentioned something about the mammary glands of cows being similar to humans. Really?
Not quite. So there are receptors. So viruses are not a living organism. They're just kind of a bundle of nucleic acid. And so there are proteins on the surface of those viruses that are recognized by cells in the host body, the host organism. And so they're brought into the cell, and that cell then is kind of hijacked and replicates that virus. So what we've learned is that the mammary tissue in dairy cow, in cattle, and we believe probably some other livestock species as well, have the same receptors as what human respiratory tracts have, as well as as birds. So they are that mammary tissue, they have those same cellular receptors that will recognize both human strains of influenza virus as well as avian strains of influenza virus. It's actually very similar to the receptors that are found in the lungs of pigs. Pigs are known as kind of a universal host for influenza viruses. So those same receptors that are found in pigs that we find that have been found in dairy cattle mammary tissue.
Gotcha. My guest is Dr. Ryan Schultz. He serves as the state veterinarian for the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and you're welcome to join this conversation by email at jx@jeffnet.org. So, Doc, talk about quarantines. When and why are they issued?
Yeah, so we do two different types of quarantines when we're talking especially about avian influenza. So anytime we have a regulated disease that we find, whether it's influenza in poultry or influenza in horses, or there's a whole list of diseases that we regulate, we control that disease at a premises level. So we will quarantine that farm. Essentially, the idea there is that our job is to make sure that that disease is stopped where it's at. And so it prevents those animals or products from those animals from leaving, potentially carrying that disease with them and spreading it. In some cases, we have diseases that are serious enough that they require more than just an individual farm quarantine. And that's where we'll see a regional quarantine enacted to essentially kind of pause movements on all of the susceptible animals in close proximity to a farm that we know is infected to make sure that that disease hasn't already spread. There are some cases with larger poultry farms where we have to do that, where we will enact a regional quarantine to be able to do surveillance around that infected farm, make sure there isn't any virus anywhere else, make sure we can satisfy our trading partners, because that's both other states as well as other countries that receive poultry products. There are standards that they require us to meet. And then as soon as we can determine the scope of that infection, make sure it's only that one farm, we're able to release that regional quarantine. In the case of avian influenza, in most cases, the on-farm quarantine is going to last for about 4 months. It's long enough that that virus will be gone from, will be inactivated in the environment. There's no surviving virus in the environment. Every disease has different timelines for quarantines of how long that is, anywhere from a week to a couple of weeks up to, in this case, a couple of months potentially.
Gotcha. But how do you monitor and enforce it?
Yeah, that's a tough one. A lot of it is working with the owners. You know, in this case, those birds have either been euthanized or have died. And so typically there aren't any birds left. And so really it's making sure that they're not bringing new birds onto the property. Most people, that hasn't really been a fight we've had to have. Most people understand that the reason for that quarantine is because there is still virus there. If they bring new birds onto the property, those birds are potentially going to get infected again, and they're going to go through that traumatic event all over again. And so it really is for everyone's good that we're doing that. In some of the other diseases, there's different methods we do. You know, some of the horse diseases where we have to quarantine a barn or something like that, it depends a lot on the situation, but we often are on site frequently, especially early on in those quarantines and monitoring those animals.
Is there a One Health assessment measure?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
When you talk about a One Health system and how diseases mm-hmm. can, you know, spill over and, you know, there are sentinels yeah. out there in animals, is there an overall measurement that you have of the health of a region through this One Health system?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. I'm going to say that I'm sure there are different metrics that are being used to try and measure and come up with algorithms to do that. I will say that work is likely being done by people that are far smarter than me, and have the epidemiologists and the researchers and scientists that are kind of looking at that side of it. My time tends to be spent in the trenches, dealing with the diseases as they come up and trying to put measures, ensure we have measures in place to prevent them and respond. So unfortunately, I don't really have the mechanism to be able to look at that kind of a metric. And I don't know that there's a universal metric that would be accepted across the board that everyone could look at and say, yeah, we've got an 85% right now, but you know, we were at a 82% last year, and you know, someone in New York is looking at that same metric.
Right.
I think it's largely whatever model is being fit to the situation, I think.
Okay, well, I'm running out of time, but I have one more question mm-hmm. for you. Are there any concerns that we should be aware of here in Southern Oregon?
You know, I think one thing I would say, and it's not unique to Southern Oregon. It's really anywhere in Oregon. Although in Southern Oregon, you do tend to have, we tend to see a lot of smaller bodies of water that birds are landing at, as well as very large bodies of water that birds are overwintering at. And so you guys in Southern Oregon do tend to see a lot of interaction between those wild waterfowl with a lot of those smaller farms that tend to be more rural, tend to be kind of off the beaten path, and have close proximity to those those bodies of water where you see a lot of wild waterfowl, that interaction between those wild waterfowl and domestic waterfowl or domestic poultry is really the risk that we are so worried about.
Okay, well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you, Dr. Schultz.
Absolutely. Thank you.